Hello and welcome to Presenting, a podcast where we chat about various topics related to role-playing games, typically Paizo products such as Pathfinder and Starfinder, but also others. I'm John Godek, and with me today is Jessica Redkop. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to finally connect with you for an interview. I've run into you at least twice at cons, but I don't know that we've spoken very much. I wasn't doing a lot of interviews then and still pretty shy about meeting people and things. And you were already an established freelancer. And it's like, a little intimidating to me, I think, you know?
Well, you've interviewed people who are much more established than I am.
Well, that was since then, right? So yeah. The last time I actually saw you was at SkullCon 2 years ago.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's been that long since we've had cons too.
Well, true. But I've interviewed a lot of people since then. That's mm-hmm. literally the con when I first started interviewing folks.
Yeah, I think you, I think Hillary said that you interviewed her then.
Right. I interviewed Hillary and Thirsty at that con. Yeah. So that was kind of I was thinking, you know, I'm going to all these cons. I should be interviewing folks. And that's when and that was like at the end of the con season, you know.
Right. And I'm notoriously more intimidating to interview than Thurston.
Oh, well. Yes, now I'm really worried. Oh, man. All right. Well, Jessica is a freelance illustrator and game designer, has worked for Paizo, Lost Spheres Publishing, and Storm Bunny Studios. Her numerous Paizo credits include both Pathfinder 1st and 2nd Edition, as well as Starfinder. In addition, she plays the character Zidani on No Direction's Valiant Actual Play podcast. Wow. You know, I've not had so many trouble with names in a long time. So
oh yeah.
I think you're following the good Paizo freelancer trend by having names that are difficult for me to grasp at the first look, you know?
Oh, have you interviewed Amber Stewart yet? That'll be fun. You can ask her about all the dragons she names.
Oh, no, I have not. That will be really scary.
Every time she's made a dragon for Pathfinder, when it goes through development, the name gets cut in like half or a third.
Well, you know, one of the things I notice in the APs in particular, but also in society play, the scenarios, is they'll put in a name and it's like, why are they making it like exceptionally challenging to figure out how they want this particular part pronounced? Like, it's never really straightforward. It's always, okay, straightforward part, and then this kind of weird thing that I don't know. Do I just make it up or do I, mm-hmm. you know, so I don't know. Well, Jessica, since you've been doing this freelancing for a while, can you tell us how you got started and what your journey was like as a freelancer?
Sure. Well, I started going to PaizoCon in 2016. And when I first started going, I was just going and running games. I had some Planescape one-shots that I'd written just to kind of fill in dead sessions at like my home with my friends. When somebody couldn't make it or the GM didn't have anything prepped, I would prepare just kind of a single session scenario adventure. And I had a couple of these built up. And the first year that I was able to go to PaizoCon, I ran some of those games. And they were pretty popular because Planescape has kind of a dedicated group of people who are still really into that setting, even though it's been so long since it was published. And so that first year that I went, in one of the games that I ran, Tim Nightingale played. And mm-hmm. he really liked the adventure that I did. And I had done illustrations for all of the pre-made characters, and I had drawn little miniatures for them and everything. And Tim was really impressed, and he said, we should get you illustrating Wayfinder. And then we kind of dropped that for a couple years. The next year, I went to PaizoCon again, and I ran more of my games. And at this point, people were starting to notice that there kept being somebody running Planescape at PaizoCon. And so after, I think, 2 years of this, people started asking me, like, so when are you going to start freelancing? Like, what is going on? Like, obviously, people like your games. There's a demand for these games. They are honestly a challenge to get into because of the way that the lottery system works at PaizoCon. Mm-hmm. I would have like half and half people signing up. Some people who are just like, oh yeah, I got this in the lottery random. And the other half of people are just like, I've been trying to get into these games for years. And there were all of these other people who have been trying to get into these games for years, but couldn't. And that was how I met Kristen Sowards, who was the publisher for Lost Spheres Publishing. And he was putting together a Kickstarter for the City of Seven Seraphs setting. Mm-hmm. So because, like, on the basis of just knowing that I loved Planescape enough to show up to PaizoCon multiple years in a row running Planescape games, Kristen looked at that and was like, yeah, I want you on my Kickstarter. Do you want to write for my book?
Wow, that's neat. And you actually, that actually launched, well, you had a panel where you talked about it and several other folks talked about it at SkullCon that, when I met you 2019. Mm-hmm. So neat. That's kind of neat how that's kind of gone full circle with that. Now, so that was your first publishing credit?
Yes. The first thing, well, it was the first book that I was hired for, but it took a little while for City of Seven Seraphs to release. So it wasn't the first thing that I wrote that was published.
Right. So how did that grow into other things then?
Well, it kind of just propelled me to, like, oh, people actually are interested in the writing that I'm doing. I'm writing adventures that people like. I'm doing setting writing that people actually, like, want to hire me to do. I should look into, like, expanding this and doing more writing. And so it was really, I guess, because of the interest that Kristen had in hiring me for his book, that kind of just gave me the push to be like, okay, I should send a writing sample to Paizo.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And I think you actually posted something about this on Facebook recently, kind of it was like one of those memory things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And could you tell us about what that said?
Oh, sure. So when I sent my writing sample to Paizo, it was in response to an open call on Twitter that Eleanor had posted. Mm-hmm. And so I had sent my writing sample into Paizo, and because I had been hired to do the City of Seven Seraphs work, but moreover, because I had been running adventures that I wrote for several years, and so I had adventures that I had written, I had like a fairly large sample of things that I could send in as a writing sample, as examples both of previous work for other publishers and of just like, I have this entire adventure that I've written. And so apparently sending in like an entire adventure basically, and like snippets of, you know, here's some of my existing published work, was an impressive writing sample.
Right. And that's why I seem to recall the quote that you had in there, is that they were very impressed with the sample that you had sent in and you were very excited about that.
I was very excited. Yeah. Because this was the first time that I had sent in a writing sample. And other than like, Kristen hired me on the basis of like my love for a setting that we both loved. He had probably not a wise decision on his part, but he had not seen any of my writing prior to hiring me.
Well,
but this was the first time that I had sent my writing to someone and they saw it and they were impressed by actually seeing my work, right?
And did they give you any gigs from that?
Oh, yeah. I sent in my sample to Eleanor, and then I think a month maybe later, I started working on one of the books for the player companion line right at the end of first edition, which then led into more work on second edition.
Well, neat. So just running things at PaizoCon, getting somebody's attention, and then taking what you've already done and kind of cold calling or sending it in. So everybody I've talked to, and I've done a bunch of interviews with freelancers, everybody has a different story. And so I'm always curious to see. And you're the first person I've talked to that has sent in a writing sample as part of your interest and gotten such positive feedback from it.
Yeah, well, being able to send in a writing sample as a way that you get your in, it doesn't depend, like, you can't just decide to do that, right? Like, it's kind of, there's either an open call for you to respond to or there isn't. And you can connect with people and show them your work, but if they're not soliciting that, if they're not asking, like, hey, freelancers, send me your work, I'm building up our freelancer Rolodex, it becomes a much different social interaction.
Mm-hmm. Now, so since then, you've done quite a bit of things for the Lost Omens line, right?
Yes.
Okay. And you've done a little bit for Starfinder as well?
I have, yeah. Most of the Starfinder work that I've done has been Monsters in the Alien Archives, and I got into doing that through PaizoCon as well, actually. There was one year at PaizoCon where I went to a panel that was like making an alien. So it was creating a Starfinder monster through like audience participation and the audience choosing what kind of abilities to give this monster and everything. And I went to this panel and I ended up pitching the name that was selected as the creature's name, which was Cephaloom. And I participated in the panel up to that on other avenues as well, but when they selected my name, I made, I guess, kind of a dad joke that I would wait for my royalties in the mail. And then when they decided to put the creature into Alien Archive 3, they actually hired me to write it.
Nice. Very cool. Very cool.
So that's my dad joke success story.
Yes. Wow. And now, so you've been writing for several different publishers and in kind of several different systems. How do these things interact for you? Do they build on each other, or do you have to like, oh, I need to shut the system down in my brain when I'm going from first edition to second edition to, you know, Planescape or whatever it is?
Oh, there's certainly a lot of referencing rules that you have to do. When I first started writing for Pathfinder, that was close to the end of the Pathfinder, like its life. It was close to the end of first edition's life. And I had been playing like third edition D&D for so long and Pathfinder for so long that I had like really just built up a lot of memory of the system and the ins and outs of it and everything to how it worked. So you could kind of just sit down and write for first edition Pathfinder, but I haven't had that much time with other systems, and I've been away from first edition for so long now that there's a lot of looking up rules now, because it is not something that you just keep straight in your head. Like, oh, I love the three actions that Pathfinder 2nd edition has so much. It is a dream to write for. It is a dream to make creatures in Pathfinder 2nd edition. I love the three actions so much. And anytime I have to do anything now with 1st edition, it's always looking up like, oh, okay, how did swift actions work? How did, like, what were the immediate actions work? What was a 5-foot step in 3rd edition? Like, it's just so many fiddly things that you have to look up. And when you're building a cool creature in 2nd edition, it's so much easier to just like, okay, is this one actions, two actions, three actions, or a reaction, versus fitting it in, like Tetrising it in with, okay, so if the creature makes an attack, what else should it be able to do? And how am I going to have it do that? And this is its swift action. And, you know.
Yeah, I agree. I love the three action economy. And I was fortunate enough to actually create some monsters for upcoming AP. And it's like, wow, it is like so much cooler than Starfinder, which is what I primarily do, or from D&D, what I played back in the day. And I really hope that sometime in the future that comes into Starfinder as well, the three action economy. Mm-hmm.
A lot of the design that I do for second edition is also inspired by the edition history as well, though. Like anytime you have a creature, like what creature is it based on? How, if it's a creature that is part of like the D&D mythos that's been created in multiple different systems, how was it created in other systems? What is the history of the creature's ability and the ways that it's worked in various editions? And a lot of what I do is kind of inspired by like things from other games or other editions, and how was that created and how can that be recreated and reinterpreted? And if there's an ability that works a certain way in D&D 3.5, like the Celerity spell, how could you take Celerity and reinterpret that on a monster in Pathfinder 2?
Don't you find that a little scary, taking a monster from, you know, a classic monster from D&D and then bring it into second edition, that people are going to look very critically at how you've done that?
Well, they're welcome to do that. Yeah. I did that in one of my first assignments for second edition. I did the Air Elementals and the Bestiary 2. And one of the decisions I made there was to add the Belker to the book. which is an appropriate place for the Belker. The Belker was in Pathfinder 1's Bestiary 2 as well. And it wasn't like explicitly a part of the assignment. Like I wasn't told do the Belker, but I love the Belker. I wanted the Belker. And the Belker has been a part of like D&D Pathfinder for a long time. So like, how was the Belker done in second edition D&D? How was the Belker done in third edition D&D? How was the Belker done in Pathfinder 1? And how can you take the kind of the spirit of what the Belker is and make an even better Belker that works even better, that has the way that its abilities interact with each other and with player actions? How could you improve that with the three actions?
Yeah, no, I can see your point there, especially how the system, I think for second edition is a relatively complex system overall. And so taking a simpler thing in fleshing out the complexity, I think is actually a pretty cool task to take on. I just, you know, for what I put together, I was intentionally not trying to do anything that existed so that I had a blank slate and I didn't have to worry about the historical perspective. And maybe because I'm relatively new at making monsters, that's I just thought that would be a shortcut I should take.
Well, it's certainly like creating new stuff is also its own challenge. Like if you have a blank slate and you're working to build up that and kind of create something where all of the ideas are your own original idea, like that's a difficult task as well. It's certainly a different task than taking something like a Mephit and reinterpreting that into a different system. But taking existing creatures and reinterpreting them is something that personally, for my own use in like home games, it's something that I have a lot of experience doing because I love the Planescape setting, but I have no interest at all in running second edition Dungeons and Dragons. So I spent years taking second edition monsters and or second edition D&D monsters and translating them into first edition Pathfinder.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's actually, I see a lot of people that do those sorts of translations, and that's not I guess that's not something I really have envisioned myself doing at this point for things. So I just can't, I don't see that in my brain as well as other people would. Now, you mentioned briefly that you were doing illustrations for all your Planescape games, and you also mentioned Tim Nightingale. Did you ever get around to doing art for Wayfinder?
Yeah, I've done illustrations for three or four Wayfinders now. The one coming out this year, I will have illustrations in. And then I have illustrations in last year and the year before as well.
Oh, cool. So the two Starfinder-based ones and now a second edition-based one.
Yes. And, okay, so it's been four then, because I did one for the last Pathfinder first edition one as well.
So how do you find doing freelance illustration, how does that compare to freelance writing?
Well, I started as an illustrator first. Like, even back as a child in like third grade, fourth grade, I was intensely invested in Sailor Moon. And it was through my love for Sailor Moon that I started doing illustrations, because I wanted to draw my original character, Sailor Scout, and this and that. And it kept building for years. And when I was a kid, I was convinced that like, oh, I wanted to draw comics and that was what I wanted to do with my life. And so I feel like I've spent a lot more time developing myself as an artist, when in truth, everything that I was doing as an artist had like a writing component to it as well. Like being interested in comics, comics are both a visual and a written medium. And so it feels weird to me now that the majority of the work that I get is writing work, but I kind of just slipped into doing that. Whereas being an illustrator was kind of the thing that I always built my identity more around, but it's probably the thing that I'm weaker at and that I do less.
So you mentioned comics there. Are you still reading comics now, or is it just Sailor Moon?
There are some comics that I love a lot. I haven't really read any contemporary comics, but comics as a medium are very, very cool. I really like Transmetropolitan and Preacher, but mm-hmm. I will say that the Preacher TV show is a better Preacher than Preacher.
Oh, really? Yes. I'm not familiar with the graphic novel, or I don't even know if it's a graphic novel or a comic or
not. Yeah, it is. It's a graphic novel, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of times it doesn't translate as well, you know, so it's interesting that you think the show is better. I was just watching on Amazon Prime, they have Kirkman's bringing over his Invincible comic over to Amazon Prime. And now it's like, I'm thinking maybe I need to go back to the comic because I'd never heard of it before. In the cartoon show or TV show is actually quite cool, you know, so.
Yeah, I haven't read Invincible, but my roommate likes it a lot. Yeah. And so I expect that we will probably watch the first episode or two of it. He will make a judgment call as to whether this is a good interpretation or not. And then that will kind of set the tone for whether we continue with it.
Well, I was a little surprised at the first one. And then I remember that, you know, he also, you know, did that whole run of The Walking Dead. And so it kind of makes sense. There's a lot of the same flavors that you saw if you went through The Walking Dead comics as well. So.
Yeah, there's a lot of comics media that is getting translated into TV shows now. And I think the television show format is a lot better for comics than the movie format was.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. I think the serial format really matches up better with the serial format of comics.
Yeah.
So now you also have dressed up at various conventions, so doing some live action role playing. Do you do this outside of... Do you do it outside of conventions as well?
I do. I started LARPing a couple of years ago, yes. The dressing up that I've done at cons, I haven't really done like a convention in a full costume, but I have started a little bit like wearing masks that I own or like fawn ears or antlers or this and that. And sometimes, like when I was at Gen Con, somebody asked me what character I was dressed up as when I was just like myself in my regular clothes. So I understand how my like evil wizard aesthetic kind of makes me look like I'm in costume all the time.
Oh, what? How did you respond to that?
I was too baffled, and I was also on an escalator going the opposite direction them. So I didn't respond.
Didn't have to worry about that too much. So what? So you talked about PaizoCon. I've seen you at SkullCon as well and Gen Con. Mm-hmm. Do you go to Origins too?
I've never been to Origins. OrcaCon, PaizoCon, and SkullCon are my main conventions. And then I've been to Gen Con once, and I've been to GameholeCon once.
Now, I've talked to somebody else that mentioned going to OrcaCon, and they had an interesting response. Why do you like going to OrcaCon?
My response is probably going to be the same as what you've heard before. I love OrcaCon because it's just a chill, good time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the other person talked about there are a lot of writers and people they know that go there and hang out. And so it's not so much for the convention and, you know, like Gen Con is just this big, massive thing. PaizoCon is actually quite large as well. I think SkullCon's a little bit more intimate. OrcaCon is, I think, even more intimate in certain parts. But there are other parts that are pretty big. So,
OrcaCon has a bigger footprint and more attendees than SkullCon does. But for me, in the way that I attend it, it has the same kind of chill, intimate vibes that SkullCon has. Mm-hmm. Because SkullCon is kind of just like a whole bunch of gaming all in one room. Right. And then chill vibes in like the hotel lobby, right? Mm-hmm. And OrcaCon is kind of similar. Like I spend most of my time at OrcaCon just in the hotel lobby by the Starbucks.
And I think the area around OrcaCon is a little bit nicer than where SkullCon was last time. So
The other thing that's great about OrcaCon is that because it's another Seattle con, but because it's not a big con, a lot of people from Paizo and from Wizards can attend it casually.
Right.
They don't have other commitments that they have to constantly rush off to. So as long as you have like met someone and you're not necessarily meeting them for the first time, if you want to do some like chill times networking, this is mm-hmm. a great place to do it.
Right. And that kind of makes sense. And I've only been to one OrcaCon, and that's the general sense I get is it's I see a lot of people saying, hey, let's go meet up there, and not so much, yeah. oh, let's go do all the games and all that kind of stuff. So
yeah.
So very neat. So what advice do you have for people interested in breaking in as a freelance RPG illustrator or writer?
Well, my advice for both is honestly the same, which is just start writing the things that you want to write or drawing the things that you want to draw. And I feel like this advice is understood and conveyed a lot easier through the lens of illustration. So I'm going to talk about it as illustration and consider that a metaphor for both. But like, if you want to be a good illustrator, that's a skill that you build up. You have to draw to get good at drawing. And the more you draw, the better mm-hmm. you'll get. And the more you draw the things that you want to draw, the more you'll have a fleshed out portfolio of the things that interest you and that you're building your skill at. And so if somebody wants you to illustrate for their, like, suppose you're really into drawing fairies and somebody is looking for an illustrator for fairies, and you've spent the last however long honing your skill at drawing fairies and you have this whole portfolio of all of the fairies that you've drawn, it's a lot easier to show them the proof of like, here are the fairies that I've drawn, do you like them, than it is to kind of pose to them in the abstract, I'm an illustrator, I could draw fairies, would you like me to draw fairies for you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the same goes for writing. Like, if you want to write adventures, that's a skill that you're going to want to build up. You're going to want to practice writing adventures. Like, I have the skills that I developed writing adventures for PaizoCon, and then I took some of them and translated them into the format of a published adventure. Like, I took Weeby Goblins and mm-hmm. kind of looked at the way that that was divided up, the way the information was organized. And I took one of my con adventures and translated it into that format as practice for the way that a published adventure is organized and what information you want in it and just the way that you do that. And having an adventure that you wrote as your writing sample when you want to write adventures shows the person that is looking at it like, oh yeah, this person can write an adventure. They know what goes into an adventure. It's not just like, oh, this person is interested in writing. Here's an adventure. It's something you've never done before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's really great, great advice. I mean, if this is something you want people to pay you to do, you should be already practicing that craft and have something to show for it, right?
Yeah. Start a Patreon. If you want to create monsters or items or adventures or whatever, make a Patreon, start making stuff now, post it on your Patreon. Hopefully you'll get some people subscribing to your Patreon, but even if you don't, you're building up a portfolio of work and you're honing your craft.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I, you know, that's interesting. I've seen other people do that, like with blogs and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I hadn't thought about the Patreon thing. Do you have a Patreon?
Not currently. I used to have one for paper miniatures, but mm-hmm. I set it up in a bad way so that the rewards were too much. It was too much reward.
Oh,
I was doing too much work for too little money.
Right, right, right. Yeah, and especially if you're doing other writing, that's got to be tough. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, how has the pandemic affected you and your gaming?
Oh. The pandemic has affected my gaming less than becoming a professional writer has. I haven't done as much GMing since I started writing professionally as I did before. Mm. Because the work that I have to do to prep a session is similar enough to the work that goes into writing that if I have an assignment that I have to be working on, in my brain, I'll go like, oh, you can't do this other thing. You can't prep for your leisure session. Do your work.
Wow. You know, that's an interesting point. I've been GMing a lot, but now my writing is picking up, and I'm actually starting to feel that same kind of pressure, and mm-hmm. it's making me sad now. that you say that.
Yeah, well, the solution, I think, is to just give myself office hours that I work during, mm-hmm. which will give me permission to work on other stuff outside of those hours so that I won't feel like I'm shirking my work anytime I do anything that isn't my work. Mm-hmm. And like, mm-hmm. this is completely an inside of my brain problem, right?
Right. Yeah, no, that makes sense. So you've not been doing a lot of playing in online cons or anything then, it sounds like.
I've been doing some online cons and I've been doing some online gaming. I haven't mm-hmm. done a terrible lot of GMing other than just playtesting things. Mm-hmm. But since last year, PaizoCon online, I've started doing a little bit of Pathfinder Society. Mm-hmm. So I've made a character. I'm level 2 now. And I've been playing a little bit with like other freelancers. Mm-hmm. Well, it's been a fun chill time.
Yeah, I was going to say, they are all kind of in the same boat as you, so that kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, you also play on No Directions Valiant. Is that a little bit yes. different for you?
It should be more different than it is. I should be paying more attention to the fact that it's radio, and I should be doing a better... Like, I've been trying to do a better job of remaining conscious of the fact that this is being recorded for people who will listen to it as audio only, mm-hmm. and so... When I roll something, like, even though this is in roll 20 and all of the other players can see how much damage I've done, the audience will not know unless I say. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So I need to get better at the radio aspect of it, but I love playing with the other people on Valiant.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been running an actual play for a couple of years now, and it's the same thing that one of the things that not just the player, but actually other players will chime in on that, or the GM will chime in when you do mm-hmm. something, or you have a great hit or a miss or make a save or something, just so that people will know kind of what happened. Because you're right. Otherwise, okay, you roll that. Oh, next person. It's like, wait,
yeah,
what's going on? Right. We don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm new to radio. I'm a radio baby.
Do you ever go back and listen to your episodes?
Not really.
Yeah, I some of my players do, and I edit them, so I have to, and I'm always surprised at how things sound when they've recorded versus how they sounded in my brain when we did it, you know?
Yeah.
So Jessica, can you tell us what's coming up for you? What's new that you can talk about?
Well, I am writing a game system that is for fantasy live action role playing, because a lot of LARPs that happen, you have like your vampire LARP, like your White Wolf games, and those are kind of like their own genre, and they're also kind of like when they were popping, when they were first published, there was kind of like a organized play thing that was going on where you had your different chapters. Mm-hmm. And like each city would have their chapter of Vampire the Masquerade, and that was kind of, if you wanted to play Vampire the Masquerade, you would go to your local chapter the same way that you go to like your Pathfinder Society organized play. And a lot of LARP is still structured that way, in like it's either franchises of like a big name LARP, or it's individuals who are creating their own game from the ground up. Like, in Manitoba, we have a couple different LARPs that are, as far as I'm aware, completely unique systems developed by the people who started those LARPs. And that's a big, like, barrier to entry. That's a big curve to, like, if you want a LARP but you don't want to join organized play, you have to create your own system, right? Yeah. Like, that's mm-hmm. that's a lot. So my objective is to write a fantasy LARP system that is pretty easy to run, pretty easy to play, and will be available pretty cheap on like Itch or something.
Mm-hmm. And will it have a way to record what actually happened and roll that back into kind of what's going on?
I don't understand the question.
So I interviewed Virginia Jordan, who actually helps run a LARPing organization out here in the Seattle area. And mm-hmm. one of the things she talked about is they... You know, the writers make a script as to what's going on. So you're building a system, right? So
I'm building the rules system. Right. So like the way that you would resolve skill checks and stuff like that. I'm not building a campaign or adventures.
Right. And so I guess one of the things that I was amazed at with their particular thing they were doing is, you know, something was set up and when people did things that affected like the whole story. And so I guess what I'm wondering with the system, if you have a skill check that gets resolved, is there a way that that feeds back into the story? Is it something integrated in or is that something that's separate? That's all.
Well, that's kind of like up to an individual game master, right? Like you have your Pathfinder core rules and anybody can run a Pathfinder game with their three friends or whatever, right? Like anybody can decide at any time, I'm going to run a Pathfinder game and I'm going to write my own adventure and I'm going to decide what happens in it. And that's a little bit of a different experience than running organized play. Like if you're running organized play, then you're buying the adventures and you're running through those adventures. And then you have like the reporting sheets and everything for what happens in that adventure. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm intending to write is more like the core rulebook than a series of adventures.
Got it. Right. So the core rulebook rather than chronicle sheets and everything like a scenario would have. Got it.
Right. Yeah. So like, because so much LARP is, like your interview with Virginia, so much of LARP is like an organized play, like a chapter of a LARP, and everything is like you report back the organized play and you have all of the scenarios that are written in the scripts and this and that, right? Mm-hmm. And it's more difficult to just be like, hey, I have like 10 friends who want a LARP in my backyard. Let's do it, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the niche that I am hoping that I'm aspiring to fill is the me and my 10 friends want to LARP in my backyard.
Yeah. And it makes sense. I mean, basically any game needs a core set of rules. And so, and I guess you could flavor it for different types of LARPs too, if you wanted, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm writing something that kind of ties into a lot of fantasy tropes, but it's not going to have a setting at all. It's going to be completely setting neutral. Just like, here's some rules so that you don't have to be a game designer to hit your friend with a foam sword.
Right.
And whatever you want to do for your game, whatever story you want, whatever setting you want, go for it.
Wow. And you're doing this by yourself. You're not partnering with anybody or a publisher or anything like that. You're just going to self-publish it?
My plan is to self-publish, yeah. I have a couple people who are also contributing to the book. And then there's a couple other people I've reached out to that I'm kind of waiting to hear back from, mainly for things like trying to make LARP more accessible. So like writing content for, you know, suppose your players have ADHD, what kind of accommodations are you going to want to make for those players? Mm-hmm. Or if your players use mobility aids, how are you going to modify combat to run a combat for a player with a mobility aid? That kind of stuff. I'm hiring other people to write.
No, that sounds actually really, really, really cool. I mean, I've had lots of friends that have done LARPing. I haven't done it myself in part because it takes a lot of time and I'm not really good with costumes and stuff. So, yeah. No, that sounds like it's, and I really like the accessibility aspect of it. That's really cool.
One of the other things that I'm hoping to do with the book is to hire someone. I've been in contact with a pattern maker about getting some basic patterns for like a shirt, pants, boot covers, cloak, just some basic patterns to have at the back of the book. So that even if you don't have a bunch of money to go out and buy a bunch of patterns or you don't know how to sew or whatever, like here's some basic patterns if you want them, the back of the book for anybody to use.
Mm-hmm. So like a complete how-to, this is your guide to LARPing. You know, here's a rule set. Here's how you can get some costumes and probably here's some references and where you can go next kind of thing.
Yeah, like I just, there's a lot of barriers that keep people from trying out LARP. One of those barriers is that you kind of have to join like either join like something that is an organized play thing with a big chapter of a big LARP or develop your own rules. Like that, the choice between those two things is a barrier. Mm-hmm. Obviously, any kind of neurodivergence makes it more difficult to join like an organized play thing. Mm-hmm. not having a lot of money or ability to create costumes is a barrier of entry that is kind of unique to LARP and not as present with other games, because like with Pathfinder or D&D, you can kind of like, okay, the GM has the books, I'll just show up to play. Whereas for a LARP, you do have to show up in a costume. So trying to lower the barrier of entry for getting a costume. I just want people to be able to try out LARP.
No, I think that's great. Well, Jess, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.